This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents Ringworld by Larry Niven. Chapter 1. Louis Wu. In the nighttime heart of Beirut, in one of a row of general address transfer booths, Louis Wu flicked into reality. His foot-length queue was as white and shiny as artificial snow. His skin and depilated scalp were chrome yellow. The irises of his eyes were gold. His robe was royal blue with a golden steroptic dragon superimposed. In the instant he appeared, he was smiling widely, showing pearly, perfect, perfectly standard teeth, smiling and waving. But the smile was already fading, and in a moment it was gone, and the sag of his face was like a rubber mask melting. Louis Wu showed his age. For a few moments he watched Beirut stream past him, the people flickering into the booths from unknown places, the crowds flowing past him on foot, now that the slidewalks had been turned off for the night. Then the clocks began to strike 23. Louis Wu straightened his shoulders and stepped out to join the world. In Resht, where his party was still going full blast, it was already the morning after his birthday. Here in Beirut, it was an hour earlier. In a balmy outdoor restaurant, Louis bought rounds of raki and encouraged the singing of songs in Arabic and interworld. He left before midnight for Budapest. Had they realized yet that he had walked out on his own party? They would assume that a woman had gone with him and that he would be back in a couple of hours. But Louis Wu had gone alone, jumping ahead of the midnight line, hotly pursued by the new day. 24 hours was not long enough for a man's 200th birthday. They could get along without him. Louis's friends could take care of themselves. In this respect, Louis's standards were inflexible. In Budapest were wine and athletic dances, natives who tolerated him as a tourist with money, tourists who thought he was a wealthy native. He danced the dances and he drank the wines, and he left before midnight. In Munich he walked. The air was warm and clean. It cleared some of the fumes from his head. He walked the brightly lighted slidewalks, adding his own pace to their 10 miles per hour speed. It occurred to him then that every city in the world had slidewalks, and that they all moved at 10 miles per hour. The thought was intolerable. Not new, just intolerable. Louis Wu saw how thoroughly Munich resembled Cairo and Resht, and San Francisco and Topeka and London and Amsterdam. The stores along the slidewalks sold the same products in all the cities of the world. These citizens who passed him tonight looked all alike, dressed all alike. Not Americans or Germans or Egyptians, but mere flatlanders. In 3.5 centuries, the transfer booths had done this to the infinite variety of Earth. They covered the world in a net of instantaneous travel. The difference between Moskva and Sydney was a moment of time and a 10th star coin. Inevitably, the cities had blended over the centuries until place names were only relics of the past. San Francisco and San Diego were the northern and southern ends of one sprawling coastal city. But how many people knew which end was which? Tange few these days. Pessimistic thinking for a man's 200th birthday. But the blending of the cities was real. Louis had watched it happen. All the irrationalities of place and time and custom blending into one big rationality of city, worldwide, like a dull gray paste. Did anyone today speak Deutsche, English, Francais, Espanol? Everyone spoke interworld. Style and body paints changed all at once all over the world in one monstrous surge. Time for another sabbatical? Into the unknown, alone in a single ship, with his skin and eyes and hair their own color? A beard growing randomly over his face? Nuts, said Louis to himself. I just got back from a sabbatical. 20 years ago. But it was wearing on toward midnight. Louis Wu found a transfer booth, inserted his credit card in the slot, and dialed for Sevilla. He emerged in a sunlit room. What the Tange? He wondered, blinking. The transfer booth must have blown its zap. In Sevilla, there should have been no sunlight. Louis Wu turned to dial again, then turned back and stared. He was in a thoroughly anonymous hotel room, a setting prosaic enough to make its occupant doubly shocking. Facing him from the middle of the room was something neither human nor humanoid. It stood on three legs. It regarded Louis Wu from two directions, from two flat heads mounted on flexible, slender necks. Over most of its startling frame, the skin was white and glove soft. But a thick, coarse brown mane ran from between the beast's necks, back along its spine, to cover the complex-looking hip joint of the hind leg. The two foreclaws were set wide apart, so that the beast's small, clawed hooves formed almost an equilateral triangle. Louis guessed that the thing was an alien animal. In those flat heads, there would be no room for brains. But he noticed the hump that rose between the bases of the necks, where the mane became a thick protective mop, and a memory floated up from 18 decades behind him. This was a puppeteer. A Pearson's puppeteer. Its brain and skull were under the hump. It was not an animal. It was at least as intelligent as a man. And its eyes, one to a head in deep bone sockets, stared fixedly at Louis Wu from two directions. Louis tried the door. Locked. He was locked out, not in. He could dial and vanish, but it never occurred to him. One does not meet a Pearson's puppeteer every day. The species had been gone from known space for longer than Louis Wu had been alive. Louis said, "Can I help you?" "You can," said the alien, in a voice to spark adolescent dreams. Had Louis Wu visualized a woman to go with that voice, she would have been Cleopatra, Helen of Troy, Marilyn Monroe, and Lorelei Hunts rolled into one. "Tanj." The curse seemed more than usually appropriate. "There ain't no justice." That such a voice should belong to a two-headed alien of indeterminate sex. "Be not frightened," said the alien. "Know that you can escape if need be." "In college there were pictures of things like you. You've been gone a long time, or so we thought." "When my species fled known space, I was not among them," the puppeteer replied. "I remained in known space, for my species had need of me here."
"Where have you been hiding? And where on earth are we?"
"That need not concern you. Are you Louis Wu Mgroof?"
"You knew that? You were after me in particular?"
"Yes. We found it possible to manipulate this world's network of transfer booths."
It could be done, Louis realized. It would take a fortune in bribe money, but it could be done. But why?
"That will take some explanation."
"Aren't you going to let me out of here?"
The puppeteer considered.
"I suppose I must. First, you should know that I have protection. My armament would stop you should you attack me."
Louis Wu made a sound of disgust.
"Why would I do that?"
The puppeteer made no answer.
"Now I remember. You're cowards. Your whole ethical system is based on cowardice."
"Inaccurate as it is, that judgment will serve us."
"Well, it could be worse," Louis conceded.
Every sentient species had its quirks. Surely the puppeteer would be easier to deal with than the racially paranoid Trinox, or the Kzinti with their hair-trigger-killer instincts, or the sessile Grogs with their disturbing substitute for hands. The sight of the puppeteer had jarred loose a whole attic full of dusty memories. Mixed with data on the puppeteers and their commercial empire, their interactions with humanity, their sudden and shocking disappearance. Mixed with these were the taste of Louis's first tobacco cigarette, the feel of typewriter keys under clumsy, untrained fingers, lists of inter-world vocabulary to be memorized, the sound and taste of English, the uncertainties and embarrassments of extreme youth. He'd studied the puppeteers during a college history course, then forgotten about them for 180 years. Incredible that a man's mind could retain so much. "I'll stay in here," he told the puppeteer, "if it makes you more comfortable."
"No, we must meet."
Muscles bunched and twitched beneath its creamy skin as the puppeteer nerved itself. Then the door to the transfer booth clicked open. Louis Wu stepped into the room. The puppeteer backed away a few paces. Louis dropped into a chair, more for the puppeteer's comfort than his own. He would look more harmless sitting down. The chair was of standard make, a self-adjusting masseur chair, strictly for humans. Louis noticed a faint scent now, reminiscent both of a spice shelf and of a chemistry set, more pleasant than otherwise. The alien rested on its folded hind leg.
"You wonder why I brought you here. This will take some explanation. What do you know of my species?"
"It's been a long time since college. You had a commercial empire once, didn't you? What we like to call known space was just a part of it. We know the Trinox bought from you, and we didn't meet the Trinox until 20 years ago."
"Yes, we dealt with the Trinox, largely through robots, as I recall."
"You had a business empire thousands of years old, at least, and scores of light-years across, at least. And then you left, all of you. You left it all behind. Why?"
"Can this have been forgotten? We fled the explosion of the galactic core."
"I know about that."
Dimly, Louis even remembered that the chain reaction of Novi and the hub of the galaxy had actually been discovered by aliens.
"But why run now? The core suns went nova 10,000 years ago. The light won't reach here for another 20,000 years.
"Humans," said the puppeteer, "should not be allowed to run loose. You will surely harm yourselves. Do you not see the danger? Radiation along the wavefront will make this entire region of the galaxy uninhabitable."
20,000 years is a long time."
"Extermination in 20,000 years is extermination nonetheless. My species fled in the direction of the clouds of Magellan. But some of us remained, in case the puppeteer migration should meet danger. Now it has."
"Oh, what kind of danger?"
"I am not yet free to answer that question. But you may look at this."
The puppeteer reached for something on a table. And Louis, who had been wondering where the puppeteer kept its hands, saw that the puppeteer's mouths were its hands. Good hands, too, he realized, as the puppeteer reached gingerly across to hand Louis a holoprint. The puppeteer's loose, rubbery lips extended inches beyond its teeth. They were as dry as human fingers, and they were rimmed with little finger-like knobs. Behind the square vegetarian teeth, Louis caught a glimpse of a flickering forked tongue. He took the holoprint and looked into it. At first it made no sense at all, but he kept looking, waiting for it to resolve. There was a small, intensely white disk that might have been a sun, G-O or K-9 or K-8, with a shallow cord sliced off along a straight black edge. But the blazing object could not have been a sun. Partially behind it, against a space-black background, was a strip of sky blue. The blue strip was perfectly straight, sharp-edged, solid and artificial, and wider than the lighted disk.
"Looks like a star with a hoop around it," said Louis. "What is it?"
"You may keep it to study if you wish. I can now tell you the reason I brought you here. I propose to form an exploration team of 4 members, including myself and including you."
"To explore what?"
"I am not yet at liberty to tell you that."
"Oh, come now. I'd have to be off my head to jump as blind as that."
"Happy 200th birthday," said the puppeteer.
"Thanks," Louis said, bewildered.
"Why did you leave your own birthday party?"
"That's not your concern."
"But it is. Indulge me, Louis Wu. Why did you leave your own birthday party?"
"I just decided that 24 hours weren't enough for a 200th birthday. So I went ahead and lengthened it by moving ahead of the midnight line. As an alien, you wouldn't understand."
"You were elated, then, at how well things were going?"
"No, not exactly, no." "Not elated," Louis remembered. "Quite the contrary, though the party had gone well enough."
He'd started it at 1 minute past midnight that morning. Why not? His friends were in every time band. There was no reason to waste a single minute of this day. There were sleep sets all over the house for fast, deep catnaps. For those who hated to miss anything, there were wake-up drugs, some with interesting side effects, others with none. There were guests Louis hadn't seen in 100 years, and others he met daily. Some had been Louis Wu's deadly enemies long ago. There were women he had forgotten entirely, so that he was repeatedly amazed at how his taste had changed. Predictably, too many hours of his birthday were spent performing introductions. The lists of names to be memorized beforehand. Too many friends had become strangers. And a few minutes before midnight, Louis Wu had walked into a transfer booth, dialed, and disappeared.
"I was bored stiff," said Louis Wu.
"Tell us about your last sabbatical, Louis. But how can you stand to be that much alone, Louis? How clever of you to invite the Trinnock ambassador, Louis. Long time no see, Louis. Hey, Louis, why does it take 3 Jinxians to paint a skyscraper?"
"Why does it?"
"Why does what?"
"The Jinxians."
"Oh. It takes 1 to hold the paint sprayer, and 2 to shake the skyscraper up and down. I heard that one in kindergarten. All the dead wood of my life, all the old jokes, all in 1 huge house. I couldn't take it."
"You are a restless man, Louis Wu. Your sabbaticals. It was you who originated the custom, was it not?"
"I don't remember where it started. It got on pretty well. Most of my friends do it now."
"But not as often as you. Every 40 years or thereabouts, you tire of human companionship. Then you leave the worlds of men and strike for the edge of known space. You remain outside known space, all alone in a single ship, until your need for company reasserts itself. You returned from your last sabbatical, your 4th, 20 years ago. You are restless, Louis Wu. On each of the worlds of human space, you have lived enough years to be known as a native. Tonight, you left your own birthday party. Are you becoming restless again?"
"That would be my problem, wouldn't it?"
"Yes. My problem is one of recruiting only. You would be a good choice as a member of my exploration team. You take risks, but you calculate them first. You are not afraid to be alone with yourself. You are cautious enough and clever enough to be still alive after 200 years. Because you have not neglected your medical needs, your physique is that of a man of 20. Lastly, and most important, you seem actually to enjoy the company of aliens."
"Sure." Louis knew a few xenophobes and regarded them as dolts. Life got awfully boring with only humans to talk to.
"But you would not wish to jump blind. Louis Wu, is it not enough that I, a puppeteer, will be with you? What could you possibly fear that I would not fear first? The intelligent caution of my race is proverbial."
"So it is," said Louis. In point of fact, he was hooked. Xenophilia and restlessness and curiosity combined. Wherever the puppeteer was going, Louis Wu was going too. But he wanted to hear more. And his bargaining position was excellent. An alien would not live in such a room by choice. This ordinary-looking hotel room, this reassuringly normal room from the viewpoint of a man of Earth, must have been furnished especially for recruiting.
"You won't tell me what it is you intend to explore," said Louis. "Will you tell me where it is?"
"It is 200 light-years from here, in the direction of the lesser cloud."
"But it'll take us nearly 2 years to get there at hyperdrive speeds."
"No. We have a ship which will travel considerably faster than a conventional hyperdrive craft. It will cover a light-year in 4/5 of a minute.
Louis opened his mouth, but nothing came out.
1 1/4 minutes?
"This should not surprise you, Louis Wu. How else could we have sent an agent to the galactic core to learn of the chain reaction of Novi? You should have deduced the existence of such a ship. If my mission is successful, I plan to turn the ship over to my crew with blueprints with which to build more. This ship, then, is your fee, salary, what have you. You may observe its flight characteristics when we join the puppeteer migration. There you will learn what it is that we propose to explore."
"Join the puppeteer migration?" "Count me in," said Louis Wu. "The chance to see an entire sentient species on the move. Huge ships carrying thousands or millions of puppeteers each, whole working ecologies."
"Good."
The puppeteer stood up.
"Our crew will number 4. We go to choose our 3rd member now.
and he trotted into the transfer booth. Louis slipped the cryptic holo into his pocket and followed. In the booth he tried to read the number on the dial, for it would have told him where in the world he was. But the puppeteer dialed too fast, and they were gone. Louis Wu followed the puppeteer out of the booth and into the dim, luxurious interior of a restaurant. He recognized the place by the black and gold decor and the space-wasteful configuration of horseshoe booths. Krushenko's in New York. Incredulous whispers followed in the path of the puppeteer. A human head waiter, imperturbable as a robot, led them to a table. One of the chairs had been removed at that table and replaced by a big square pillow, which the alien placed between hip and hind hoof as it sat down. "You were expected," Louis deduced. "Yes, I called ahead. Krushenko's is accustomed to serving alien guests." Now Louis noticed other alien diners, four Kazinti at the next table, and a cadet Lino halfway across the room. It figured, with the United Nations building so close. Louis dialed for a tequila sour and took it as it arrived. "This was a good thought," he said. "I'm half-starved." "We did not come to eat. We came to recruit our third member." "Oh? In a restaurant?" The puppeteer raised its voice to answer, but what it said was not an answer. "You never met my cousin, Kachularit? I keep it as a pet." Louis' tequila tried to go down the wrong way. At the table behind the puppeteer, four walls of orange fur were each and every one a cousin, and as the puppeteer spoke, they all turned with their needle teeth bared. It looked like a smile, but on a cousin, that rictus is not a smile. The Rit name belongs to the family of the patriarch of cousin. Louis, downing the rest of his drink, decided that it didn't matter. The insult would have been mortal regardless, and you could only be eaten once. The nearest cousin stood up. Rich orange fur, with black markings over the eyes, covered what might have been a very fat tabby cat 8 feet tall. The fat was muscle, smooth and powerful and oddly arranged over an equally odd skeleton. On hands like black leather gloves, sharpened and polished claws slid out of their sheaths. A quarter of a ton of sentient carnivore stooped over the puppeteer and said, "Tell me now, why do you think that you can insult the patriarch of Kazin and live?" The puppeteer answered immediately and without a tremor in its voice. "It was I who, on a world which circles Beta Lyrae, kicked a Kazin called Chuffed Captain in the belly with my hind foot, breaking 3 struts of his endoskeletal structure. I have need of a cousin of courage." "Continue," said the cousin of the black eyes. Despite limitations imposed by the structure of his mouth, the cousin's interworld was excellent. But his voice showed no sign of the rage he must have felt. For all the emotion showed by Kazinti or puppeteer, Louis might have been watching some time-dulled ritual. But the meat set before the Kazinti was blood-raw and steaming. It had been flash-heated to body temperature just before serving, and all of the Kazinti were smiling. "This human and I," said the puppeteer, "will explore a place such as no Kazin has ever dreamed. We will need a Kazin in our crew. Dare a Kazin follow where a puppeteer leads?" "It has been said that puppeteers were plant-eaters, that they would lead away from battle and not toward it." "You shall judge. Your fee, if you survive, will be the plans for a new and valuable type of spacecraft, plus a model of the ship itself. You may consider this fee to be extreme hazard pay." The puppeteer, Louis thought, was sparing no pains to insult the Kazinti. One never offers a Kazin hazard pay. The Kazin is not supposed to have noticed the danger. But the Kazin's only remark was, "I accept." The other 3 Kazinti snarled at him. The first Kazin snarled back. 1 Kazin alone sounded like a catfight. 4 Kazinti in heated argument sounded like a major feline war, with atonics. Sonic deadeners went on automatically in the restaurant, and the snarls became remote, but they went on. Louis ordered another drink. Considering what he knew of Kazinti history, these four must have remarkable restraint. The puppeteer still lived. The argument died away, and the four Kazinti turned back. He of the black eye markings said, "What is your name?"
"I take the human name of Nessus," said the puppeteer. "My true name is..."
Orchestral music flowed for an instant from the puppeteer's remarkable throats. "Well and good, Nessus. You must understand that we four constitute a Kazinti embassy to Earth. This is Harch. That is Fatance. He with the yellow striping is Hroth. I, being only an apprentice and a Kazin of low family, bear no name. I am styled by my profession, speaker to animals." Louis bridled. "Our problem is that we are needed here. Delicate negotiations. But these are not your concern. It has been decided that I alone can be replaced. If your new kind of ship proves worth having, I will join you. Otherwise, I must prove my courage another way."
"Satisfactory," said the puppeteer, and rose.
Louis remained seated. He asked, "What is the Kazinti form of your title?"
"In the hero's tongue."
The Kazin snarled on a rising note.
"Then why didn't you give that as your title? Was it a deliberate insult?"
"Yes," said Speaker to Animals. "I was angered." Accustomed to his own standards of tact, Louis had expected the Kazin to lie. Then Louis would have pretended to believe him, and the Kazin would have been more polite in future. Too late to back out now. Louis hesitated a fraction of a second before he said,
"And what is the custom?"
"We must fight barehanded, as soon as you deliver the challenge, or one of us must apologize."
Louis stood up. He was committing suicide, but he knew Tange well what the custom was.
"I challenge you," he said, "tooth against tooth, claw against fingernail, since we cannot share a universe in peace."
Without lifting his head, the Kazin, who had been called Hroth, spoke up.
"I must apologize for my comrade, Speaker to Animals."
Louis said, "Huh?"
"This is my function," said the Kazin with the yellow striping. "To be found in situations where one must apologize or fight is Kazinti nature. We know what happens when we fight. Today, our numbers are less than an eighth of what they were when Kazin first met man. Our colony worlds are your colony worlds. Our slave species are freed and taught human technology and human ethics. When we must apologize or fight, it is my function to apologize."
Louis sat down. It seemed that he would live. He said, "I wouldn't have your job for anything."
"Obviously not, if you would fight a Kazin barehanded. But the Patriarch judges me useless for any other purpose. My intelligence is low, my health is bad, my coordination terrible. How else can I keep my name?"
Louis sipped at his drink and wished for someone to change the subject. He found the humble Kazin embarrassing.
"Let us eat," said the one called Speaker to Animals. "Unless our mission is urgent, Nessus."
"Not at all. Our crew is not yet complete. My colleagues will call me when they have located a qualified fourth crewman. By all means, let us eat."
Speaker to Animals said one thing more before he turned back to his table.
"Louis Wu, I found your challenge verbose. In challenging a Kazin, a simple scream of rage is sufficient. You scream and you leap."
"You scream and you leap," said Louis.
"Great."
Chapter 2 And His Motley Crew. Louis Wu knew people who closed their eyes when they used to transfer booth. The jump in scenery gave them vertigo. To Louis, this was nonsense, but then some of his friends were much odder than that. He kept his eyes open as he dialed. The watching aliens vanished. Someone called,
"Hi, he's back!"
A mob formed around the door. Louis forced it open against them.
"Finnegal fool you all. Didn't any of you go home?"
He spread his arms to engulf them, then pushed them forward like a snowplow, forcing them back.
"Clear the door, you boars. I've more guests coming."
"Great," a voice shouted in his ear. Anonymous Hands took his hand and forced the fingers around a drinking bulb. Louis hugged the 7 or 8 of his invited guests within the circle of his arms and smiled at his welcome. Louis Wu. From a distance he was an Oriental, with pale yellow skin and flowing white hair. His rich blue robe was carelessly draped, so that it should have hampered his movements, but it didn't. Close up, it was all a fraud. His skin was not pale yellow-brown, but a smooth chrome yellow, the color of a comic book Fu Manchu. His queue was too thick. It was not the white of age, but sheer, clean white with a subliminal touch of blue, the color of dwarf star sunlight. As with all Flatlanders, cosmetic dyes were the colors of Louis Wu. A Flatlander. You could tell at a glance. His features were neither Caucasian, nor Mongoloid, nor Negroid, though there were traces of all three. A uniform blend which must have required centuries. In a gravitational pull of 9.98 meters per second, his stance was unconsciously natural. He gripped a drinking bulb and smiled around at his guests. As it happened, he was smiling into a pair of reflective silver eyes an inch from his own. One Teela Brown had somehow ended up nose to nose and breast to breast with him. Her skin was blue with a netting of silver threads. Her coiffure was streaming bonfire flames. Her eyes were convex mirrors. She was 20 years old. Louis had talked to her earlier. Her conversation was shallow, full of clichés and easy enthusiasms, but she was very pretty.
"I had to ask you," she said breathlessly. "How did you get a Trinnoch to come?"
"Don't tell me he's still here."
"Oh, no, his air was running out and he had to go home."
"A little white lie," Louis informed her. "A Trinnoch airmaker lasts for weeks. Well, if you really want to know, that particular Trinnoch was once my guest and prisoner for a couple of weeks. His ship and crew got themselves killed at the edge of known space, and I had to ferry him to Margrave so they could set up an environment box for him." The girl's eyes registered delighted wonder. Louis found it pleasantly strange that they were on a level with his own eyes, for Teela Brown's fragile beauty made her look smaller than she really was. Her eyes shifted over Louis's shoulder and widened even further. Louis grinned as he turned. Nessus the puppeteer trotted out of the transfer booth. Louis had thought of this as they were leaving Krushenko's. He had been trying to persuade Nessus to tell them something of the proposed destination, but the puppeteer was afraid of spy beams.
"Then come to my place," Louis had suggested.
"But your guests?"
"Not in my office, and my office is absolutely bug-proof. Besides, think of the hit you'll make at the party, assuming everyone hasn't gone home by now." The impact was all Louis could have desired. The tap-tap-tap of the puppeteer's hooves was suddenly the only sound in the room. Behind him, speaker to animals flickered into existence. The Kazin considered the sea of human faces surrounding the booth. Then, slowly, he bared his teeth. Someone poured half his drink into a potted palm, the grand gesture. From one of the branches, a gummagey orchid thing chattered angrily. People edged away from the transfer booth. There were comments.
"You're okay, I see them too."
"Sober pills? Let me look in my Sporan."
"Throws a hell of a party, doesn't he?"
"Good old Louis."
"What did you call that thing?"
They didn't know what to make of Nessus. Mostly they ignored the puppeteer. They were afraid to comment on him, afraid of sounding like fools. They reacted even more curiously to speaker to animals. Once mankind's most dangerous enemy, the Kazin was being treated with awed deference, like some kind of hero.
"Follow me," Louis told the puppeteer. With luck, the Kazin would follow them both.
"Excuse us," he bellowed, and pushed his way into the throng. In response to various excited and or puzzled questions, he merely grinned secretively. Safely in his office, Louis barred the door and turned on the bug-proofing set.
"Okay, who needs refreshment?"
"If you can eat some bourbon, I can drink it," said the Kazin. "If you cannot eat it, I can still drink it."
"Nessus?"
"Any kind of vegetable juice will serve. Have you warm carrot juice?"
"Ugh," said Louis.
But he instructed the bar, which produced bulbs of warm carrot juice. While Nessus rested on its folded hind leg, the Kazin dropped heavily onto an inflated hassock. Under his weight, it should have exploded like any lesser balloon. Man's second oldest enemy looked curious and ridiculous, balanced on a hassock too small for him. The Man-Kazin wars had been numerous and terrible. Had the Kazinti won the first of these, mankind would have been a slave and a meat animal for the rest of eternity. But the Kazinti had suffered in the wars which followed. They tended to attack before they were ready. They had little concept of patience and no concept of mercy or of limited war. Each war had cost them a respectable chunk of population and the punitive confiscation of a couple of Kazinti worlds. For 250 years, the Kazinti had not attacked human space. They had nothing to attack with. For 250 years, men had not attacked the Kazinti worlds, and no Kazin could understand it. Men confused them terribly. They were rough and they were tough, and Nessus, an avowed coward, had insulted four fully grown Kazinti in a public restaurant. "Tell me again," said Louis, "about a puppeteer's proverbial caution. I forget." "Perhaps I was not strictly fair with you, Louis. My species judges me mad." "Oh, fine." Louis sucked at the bulb an anonymous donor had handed him. It held vodka and drubelberry juice and shaved ice. The Kazin's tail lashed restlessly. "Why should we ride with an avowed maniac? You must be madder than most to wish to ride with a Kazin."
"You alarm yourselves too easily," said Nessus in its soft, persuasive, unbearably sensual voice. "Men have never met a puppeteer who was not mad in the judgment of his own species. No alien has ever seen the puppeteer world, and no sane puppeteer would trust his very life to the fallible life support system of a spacecraft, or the unknown and possibly deadly dangers of an alien world."
"A mad puppeteer, a fully grown Kazin, and me. Our fourth crew member had better be a psychiatrist."
"No, Louis, none of our candidates are psychiatrists."
"Well, why not?"
"I did not select at random."
The puppeteer sucked at its bulb with one mouth and talked with the other.
"First, there was myself. Our proposed voyage is intended to benefit my species, hence we must include a representative. Such a one should be mad enough to face an unknown world, yet sane enough to use his intellect to survive. I, as it happens, am just on the borderline. We had reason to include a Kazin. Speaker to animals, what I tell you now is secret. We have been observing your species for some considerable time."
"We knew of you even before you attacked humanity."
"Well, that you did not show yourselves," rumbled the Kazin.
"Doubtless. At first we deduced that the Kazinti species was both useless and dangerous. Lines of research were initiated to determine whether your species could be exterminated in safety."
"I will tie your necks in a bow knot."
"You will commit no violence."
The Kazin stood up. "He's right," said Louis. "Sit down, Speaker. You don't stand to profit by murdering a puppeteer." The Kazin sat down. Again his hassock did not collapse.
"The project was cancelled," said Nessus. "We found that the Man-Kazin wars put sufficient restriction on Kazinti expansion, made you less dangerous. We continued to watch. 6 times over several centuries you attacked the worlds of men. 6 times you were defeated, having lost approximately 2/3 of your male population in each war. Need I comment on the level of intelligence displayed? No. In any case, you were never in real danger of extermination. Your non-sentient females were largely untouched by war, so that the next generation helped to replace the numbers lost. Still, you steadily lost an empire you had built up over thousands of years. It became apparent to us that the Kazinti were evolving at a furious rate."
"Evolving?"
Nessus snarled a word in the hero's tongue. Louis jumped. He had not suspected that the puppeteer's throats could do that.
"Yes," said Speaker to Animals. "I thought that was what you said, but I do not understand the application."
"Evolution depends on the survival of the fittest. For several hundred Kazin years, the fittest of your species were those members with the wit or the forbearance to avoid fighting human beings. The results are apparent. For nearly 200 Kazin years, there has been peace between man and Kazin."
"But there would be no point. We could not win a war."
"That did not stop your ancestors."
Speaker to Animals gulped at his hot bourbon. his tail, naked and pink and rat-like, lashed in turmoil.
"Your species has been decimated," said the puppeteer. "All Kazinti alive today are descended from those who avoided death in the Man-Kazin Wars. Some among us speculate that the Kazinti now have the intelligence or the empathy or the self-restraint necessary to deal with races alien to them."
"And so you risk your life to travel with the Kazin?"
"Yes," said Nessus, and shivered all over. "My motivation is strong. It has been implied that if I can demonstrate the worth of my courage by using it to perform a valuable service for my species, I will be allowed to breed."
"Hardly a firm commitment," said Louis.
"Then there is another reason to take a Kazin. We will face strange environments, hiding unknown dangers. Who will protect me? Who would be better equipped than a Kazin?"
"To protect a puppeteer?
Does that sound insane?"
"It does," said Speaker to Animals. "It also appeals to my sense of humor. What of this one, this Louis Wu?"
"For us there has been much profitable cooperation with men. Naturally, we choose at least one human. Louis Gridley Wu is a proven survival type, in his casual, reckless way."
"Casual he is, and reckless. He challenged me to single combat."
"Would you have accepted, had not Roth been present? Would you have harmed him?"
"To be sent home in disgrace, having caused a major interspecies incident?"
"But that is not the point," the Kazin insisted.
"Is it?"
"Perhaps it is. Louis is alive. You are now aware that you cannot dominate him through fear. Do you believe in results?"
Louis maintained a discreet silence. If the puppeteer wanted to give him credit for cool intellection, that was fine with Louis Wu.
"You have spoken of your own motives," said Speaker. "Speak now of mine. What can it profit me to join your voyage?" And they got down to business.
To the puppeteers, the Quantum II hyperdrive shunt was a white elephant. It would move a ship a light year in 1.25 minutes, where conventional craft would cross that distance in 3 days. But conventional craft had room for cargo.
"We built the motor into a General Products No. 4 hull, the biggest made by our company. When our scientists and engineers had finished their work, most of the interior was filled with the machinery of the hyperdrive shunt. Our trip outward will be cramped."
"An experimental vehicle," said the Kazin. "How thoroughly has it been tested?"
"The vehicle has made one trip to the galactic core and back."
"But that had been its only flight.
The puppeteers could not test it themselves, nor could they find other races to do the work, for they were in the middle of a migration." The ship would carry practically no cargo, though it was over 1 mile in diameter. Furthermore, it could not slow down without dropping back into normal space.
"We do not need it," said Nessus. "But you do. We plan to turn the ship over to our crew, together with copies of the plans for making more. Doubtless you can improve the design yourselves."
"That will buy me a name," said the Kazin.
"A name?
I must see your ship in action."
"During our trip outward."
"The Patriarch would give me a name for such a ship. I am sure he would.
What name should I choose? Perhaps..."
The Kazin snarled on a rising note. The puppeteer replied in the same language. Louis shifted in irritation. He couldn't follow the hero's tongue. He considered leaving them to it, then had a better idea. He pulled the puppeteer's holo from his pocket, scaled it across the room into the Kazin's furry lap. The Kazin held it delicately in his padded black fingers.
"It appears to be a ringed star," he observed. "What is it?"
"It relates to our destination," said the puppeteer. "I cannot tell you more. Not now."
"How cryptic. Well, when may we depart?"
"I estimate a matter of days. My agents are even now searching for a qualified fourth member for our exploration team."
"And so we wait upon their pleasure. Louis, shall we join your guests?"
Louis stood up, stretching.
"Sure, let's give him a thrill.
Speaker, before we go out there, I have a suggestion. Now, don't take this as an assault on your dignity. It's just an idea." The party had split into sections. Tri-D watchers, bridge and poker tables, lovers in pairs and larger groups, tellers of tales, victims of ennui. Out on the lawn, under a hazy early morning sun, was a mixed group of ennui victims and xenophiles. For the outdoor group included Nessus and Speaker to Animals. It also included Louis Wu, Tila Brown, and an overworked bartender. The lawn was one of those tended according to the ancient British formula, seed and roll for 500 years. 500 years had ended in a stock market crash, after which Louis Wu had had money and a certain venerable baronial family had not. The grass was green and glossy, obviously the real thing. Nobody had ever tampered with its genes in search of dubious improvements. At the bottom of the rolling green slope was a tennis court where diminutive figures ran and jumped and swung their oversized fly swatters with great energy. "Exercise is wonderful," said Louis. "I could sit and watch it all day." Tila's laugh surprised him. He thought idly of the millions of jokes she had never heard, the old, old ones nobody ever told any more. Of the millions of jokes Louis knew by heart, 99% must be obsolete. Past and present mix badly. The bartender floated next to Louis in tilted position. Louis's head was in Tila's lap, and his need to reach the keyboard without sitting up was responsible for the bartender's tilt. He tapped an order for 2 mochas, caught the bulbs as they dropped from the slot, and handed one to Tila. "You look like a girl I knew once," he said. "Ever hear of a Paula Cherenkov?"
"The cartoonist, Boston-born?"
"Yeah. Lives on We Made It nowadays."
"My great-great-grandmother. We visited her once."
"She gave me a severe case of whiplash of the heart long ago. You could be her twin."
Tila's chuckle sent vibrations bouncing pleasantly along Louis's vertebrae.
"I promise not to give you a case of whiplash of the heart if you'll tell me what it is."
Louis thought about that. The phrase was his own, created to describe to himself what had happened to him at that time. He hadn't used it often, but he'd never had to explain it. They always knew what he meant. A calm, peaceful morning. If he went to sleep now, he'd sleep for 12 hours. Fatigue poisons were giving him an exhaustion high. Tila's lap was a comfortable resting place for his head. Half of Louis's guests were women, and many of them had been his wives or lovers in other years. During the first phase of the party, he'd celebrated his birthday privately with 3 women— 3 who had been very important to him once, and vice versa. 3? 4? No, 3. And now it seemed that he was immune to whiplash of the heart. 200 years had left too much scar tissue on his personality. And now he rested his head idly and comfortably in the lap of a stranger who looked exactly like Paula Cherenkov. "I fell in love with her," he said. "We'd known each other for years. We'd even dated. Then one night we got to talking, and wham, I was in love. I thought she loved me, too. We didn't go to bed that night, together, I mean. I asked her to marry me. She turned me down. She was working on a career. She didn't have time to get married, she said. But we planned a trip to Amazon National Park, a sort of 1-week ersatz honeymoon. The next week was all highs and lows. First, the high. I had the tickets and the hotel reservations. Did you ever fall so hard for someone that you decided you weren't worthy of him?
No.
I was young. I spent 2 days convincing myself I was worthy of Paula Cherenkov. I did it, too. Then she called and canceled the trip. I don't even remember why. She had some good reason. I took her out to dinner a couple of times that week. Nothing happened. I tried to keep from pressuring her. Chances are she never guessed the pressure I was under. I was going up and down like a yo-yo. Then she lowered the boom. She liked me. We had fun together. We should be good friends. I wasn't her type, said Louis. I thought we were in love. Maybe she thought so, too, for about a week. She wasn't cruel. She just didn't know what was going on.
But what was the whiplash?
Louis looked up at Tila Brown. Silver eyes looked blankly back, and Louis realized that she hadn't understood a word. Louis had dealt with aliens. By instinct or by training, he had learned to sense when some concept was too foreign to be absorbed or communicated. Here was a similar fundamental gap in translation. What a monstrous gulf to separate Louis Wu and a 20-year-old girl. Could he really have aged that drastically? And if so, was Louis Wu still human? Teela, blank-eyed, waited for enlightenment.
Tanj, Louis cursed, and he rolled to his feet.
Mud spots slid slowly down his robe and dripped off the hem. Nessus the puppeteer was holding forth on the subject of ethics. He interrupted himself, quite literally, speaking with both mouths, to the delight of his admirers, to answer Louis's query. No, there had been no word from his agents. Speaker to animals, similarly surrounded, sprawled like a great orange hill across the grass. Two women were scratching at the fur behind his ears. The odd Kazinti ears, that could expand like pink Chinese parasols or fold flat against the head, were spread wide, and Louis could see the design tattooed on each surface.
So, Louis called to him, was I not brilliant?
You were, the Kazin rumbled without stirring.
Louis laughed inside himself. A Kazin is a fearsome beast, yes? But who can fear a Kazin who's having his ears scratched? It put Louis's guests at their ease, and it put the Kazin at ease, too. Anything above the level of a field mouse likes having its ears scratched.
They have been taking turnabout, the Kazin rumbled sleepily. A male approaches the female scratching me and observes that he would enjoy the same attention. The two go off together. Another female moves in as a replacement. How interesting it must be to belong to a race of two sentient sexes.
Sometimes it makes things awfully complicated.
Indeed.
The girl at the Kazin's left shoulder, space black her skin was, embroidered with stars and galaxies, and her hair was the cold white stream of a comet's tail, looked up from her work.
Teela, take over, she said gaily. I'm hungry.
Teela knelt obligingly beside the great orange head. Louis said, Teela Brown meets speaker to animals. May you both be... From nearby came a discordant blast of music.
Very happy together. What was that? Oh, Nessus, what?
The music had come from the puppeteer's remarkable throats. Now Nessus nudged rudely between Louis and the girl.
You are Teela Gendrova Brown, ident number IKLUGGTYN?
The girl was startled, but not frightened.
That's my name. I don't remember my ident number. What's the problem? We've been combing Earth for you for nearly a week. Now I find you at a gathering I reached only by chance. I will have harsh words for my agents.
Oh, no, Louis said softly. Teela stood up somewhat awkwardly.
I haven't been hiding, not from you and not from any other extraterrestrial. Now what's the problem?
Hold it, Louis stepped between Nessus and the girl. Nessus, Teela Brown obviously isn't an explorer. Pick someone else.
But Louis...
Just a moment. The Kazin was sitting up. Louis, let the herbivore choose his own team members.
But look at her!
Look at yourself, Louis. Barely 2 meters long, slender even for a human. Are you an explorer? Is Nessus?
Just what the Tanj is going on, Teela demanded.
Urgently, Nessus said,
Louis, let us retire to your office. Teela Brown, we must make a proposal to you. You are under no obligation to accept, nor even to listen, but you may find our proposal interesting.
The argument continued in Louis's office.
She fits my qualifications, Nessus insisted. We must consider her.
She can't be the only one on Earth.
No, Louis, not at all, but we have been unable to contact any of the others. Just what am I being considered for?
The puppeteer started to tell her. It developed that Teela Brown had no interest in space, had never even been as far as the moon, and had no intention of going beyond the borders of known space. The second quantum hyperdrive did not arouse her cupidity. When she started to look harassed and confused, Louis broke in again.
Nessus, just what are the qualifications Teela fits so well?
My agents have been seeking the descendants of winners of the birthright lotteries.
I quit. You're genuinely insane.
No, Louis. My orders come from the hindmost himself, from the one who leads us all. His sanity is not in question. May I explain?
For human beings, birth control had long been an easy matter. Nowadays, a tiny crystal was inserted under the skin of the patient's forearm. The crystal took a year to dissolve. During that year, the patient would be unable to conceive a child. In earlier centuries, clumsier methods had been used. Earth's population had been stabilized about the middle of the 21st century at 18 billion. The Fertility Board, a subsection of the United Nations, made and enforced the birth control laws. For more than half a thousand years, those laws had remained the same. 2 children to a couple, subject to the judgment of the Fertility Board. The board decided who might be a parent how many times. The board might award extra children to one couple, deny any children at all to another, all on the basis of desirable or undesirable genes.
Incredible, said the Kazin.
Why, things were getting pretty tonch crowded with 18 billion people trapped in a primitive technology.
If the Patriarch tried to force such a law on Kazinti, we would exterminate the Patriarch for its insolence.
But men were not Kazinti. For half a thousand years, the laws had held good. Then, 200 years ago, had come rumors of chicanery in the Fertility Board. The scandal had ultimately resulted in drastic changes in the birth control laws. Every human being now had the right to be a parent once, regardless of the state of his genes. In addition, the birthrights second and third could come automatically. For a high-tested IQ, or for proven useful psychic powers, such as plateau eyes or absolute direction, or for survival genes like telepathy or natural longevity or perfect teeth. One could buy the birthrights at 1,000,000 stars a shot. Why not? The knack for making money was a tested, proven survival factor. Besides, it cut down on bribery attempts. One could fight for the birthrights in the arena, if one had not yet used up his birthright first. Winner to earn his birthrights second and third, loser to lose his birthright first and his life. It evened out.
I have seen such battles on your entertainment shows, said the speaker. I thought they were fighting for fun.
Nope, they're serious, said Louis. Tila giggled.
And the lotteries?
It comes out short, said Nessus. Even with booster spice to prevent aging in humans, more die on Earth than are born in any given year.
And so each year the Fertility Board totaled up the year's deaths and emigrations, subtracted the year's births and immigrations, and put the resulting number of birthrights into the New Year's Day lottery. Anyone could enter. With luck, you could have 10 or 20 children, if that was luck. Even convicted criminals could not be excluded from the birthright lotteries.
I've had 4 children myself, said Louis Wu. One by lottery.
You'd have met 3 of them if you'd come 12 hours earlier.
It sounds very strange and complex. When the population of Kazin grows too great, we
attack the nearest human world.
Not at all, Louis. We fight each other. The more crowded we grow, the more opportunity exists for one Kazin to take offense at another. Our population problem adjusts itself. We've never been within an order of magnitude of your 2 × 8⁰ humans on a single planet.
I think I begin to get it, said Tila Brown. My parents were both lottery winners. She laughed somewhat nervously. Otherwise, I wouldn't even have been born. Come to think of it, my grandfather... All of your ancestors for 5 generations were born by reason of winning lottery tickets.
Really? I never knew that.
The records are quite clear, Nessus assured her.
The question remains, said Louis Wu. So what?
Those who rule in the puppeteer fleet have speculated that the people of Earth are breeding for luck.
Huh?
Tila Brown leaned forward in her chair, intensely curious. Doubtless she had never before seen a mad puppeteer.
Think of the lotteries, Louis. Think of evolution. For 700 years, your people bred by the numbers. 2 birthrights per person, 2 children per couple. Here and there, one might win a 3rd birthright or be refused his 1st on adequate grounds, diabetic genes or the like. But most of humanity had 2 children. Then the law was changed. For the past 2 centuries, between 10% and 13% of each human generation has been born by right of a winning lottery ticket. What determines who will survive and breed? On Earth, luck.
and Teela Brown is the daughter of 6 generations of winning gamblers. Chapter 3. Teela Brown. Teela was giggling helplessly.
"Come off it," said Louis Wu. "You can't."